deck, he again set the submersible down. Giordino had pulled the ROV's cable slack and was preparing to drop it into its cradle. "Hold on," Pitt said. "Do you see that broken timber standing upright about 10 feet in front of us?"
"Got it."
"There's a covered object near its base, a little to the right. See if you can blast it off with the ROV." Giordino had the rover in place within seconds. He cut the power and let the ROV sink to a small pile of debris covered in silt. When the ROV made contact, he applied full power to its tiny thrusters. The little ROV shot upward, kicking up a thick cloud of silt in the process. The steady bottom current that rippled over the ship quickly cleared away the murky water. Both men could see a curved object with a gold luster lying in the debris.
"My gold bars," Giordino said facetiously.
"Something better, I think," Pitt replied. He didn't wait for Giordino to fly the ROV over the object, instead propelling the submersible over for a close-up look. Peering down through the viewport, they saw the unmistakable shape of a large bell.
"Holy smokes! How did you pick that out of the muck?" Giordino asked.
"The bloodhound sniffer did it. I noticed a small reading of copper and zinc and remembered that they're the two components of brass. I figured it was either a cleat or the ship's bell." They stared down at the bell, observing an engraving on the side which they couldn't quite make out. Pitt finally backed off a few feet and let the ROV zoom in for a closer look. The bell was still caked with silt and crustaceans, but a close-up view from the rover's camera revealed two of the engraved letters. E-R.
"Can't spell Erebus without it," Giordino remarked with some relief.
"Give it another blast," Pitt directed. While Giordino maneuvered the ROV in for another go at the silt, Pitt checked their battery reserves, finding their remaining power was down to 30 minutes. There was little time left to lose. The silt burst upward in a massive cloud of brown particulates from the rover's second burst. It seemed to Pitt that the water took hours to clear, when in fact it was just a few seconds. Giordino immediately guided the ROV back over the bell as they waited for the murky cloud to drift away. They both stared silently at the monitor as the bell's engraved lettering slowly materialized in its entirety. It spelled terror. Chapter 67. After 3 days of confinement in the frozen darkness, the barge captives were living a different kind of terror. Roman had ordered the fading penlights to be used sparingly, so most of the time the men spent groping around in complete blackness. Initial feelings of anger and determination to escape had waned to despair in the bleak hold, where the men huddled close together to stave off hypothermia. Hope had flourished when the barge had come to a rest at the dock and the hatch was briefly thrown open. It proved to be nothing more than an inspection from several armed guards, but at least they had provided some food and blankets before their hasty exit. Roman took it as a good sign. They wouldn't be given food if they weren't intended to be kept alive, he reasoned. But now he wasn't so sure. When Bjorkes had awakened him to report a change in the sound of the icebreaker's engines, he suspected that they had reached their destination. But then the rhythmic tugging of the tow ropes had suddenly ceased while the rocking motion from the choppy seas remained. He could sense that they had been cut adrift. Seconds later, Zack's explosives detonated with a jolt. The explosion reverberated through the empty holds of the barge like a thunderstorm in a bottle. Instantly, the commandos and Polar Dawn's crew were on their feet, wondering what had happened. "Captain Murdoch," Roman called out, turning on his penlight. Murdoch shuffled forward, a haggard look to his eyes from a lack of sleep.
"Speculation?" Roman asked quietly.
"Sounded well aft. I suggest we go take a look."
Roman agreed. Then, seeing the apprehensive look in the faces of the nearby men, he called over to Bjorkes. "Sergeant, get back to work on that hatch. I'd like some fresh air in here before breakfast." Moments later, the stocky sergeant was pounding away at the locked hatch again with his small hammer. The clanging racket, Roman hoped, would give the men a small lift while masking the sound of whatever was happening aft. Roman led Murdoch to the open stern hatchway and shined his light over the threshold. A steel-rung ladder led straight down into an empty black void.
"After you, Captain," Murdoch said curtly.
Roman slipped the penlight between his teeth, then grabbed the top rung and slowly started climbing down. Though not afraid of heights, he found it unnerving to climb into a seemingly bottomless black hole inside a rolling ship. The bottom rung seemed elusive, but after a 40-foot drop, he reached the base of the number one hold. Shining his light at the foot of the ladder, Murdoch appeared right behind him. A rock-solid man just over 60, the gray-bearded captain was not even breathing hard. Murdoch led the way across the hold, startling a pair of rats that somehow flourished even in the bitter cold.
"Didn't want to say it in front of the men, but that sounded like an onboard explosion to me," he said.
"My thoughts as well," Roman replied.
"Do you think they mean to sink us?"
"We'll know soon enough."
The two men found another steel ladder on the opposite side of the hold, which they climbed up to a short passage that led to the number two hold. They repeated the process twice more, crossing the next two holds. As they climbed up the far side of the third hold, they could hear a distant sound of sloshing water. Reaching the last passageway, Roman scanned the number four hold with his light. On the opposite corner, they spied a small river of water streaming down the bulkhead, splashing into a growing pool below. The explosion had left no gaping hole in the side of the hull, but rather created a series of buckled steel plates that let the water seep in like a broad sieve. Murdoch studied the damage and shook his head.
"Nothing we can do to slow that down," he said. "Even if we had the proper materials, it's too widely dispersed."
"The water inflow doesn't look too extreme," Roman said, searching for something positive.
"It will only get worse. The damage appears to be just above the waterline, but the rough seas are spilling in. As the hold fills, the barge will begin to settle by the stern, allowing more water to rush in. The flooding will only accelerate.
But there's a hatch on the passageway that we can lock. If the water is confined to this hold, shouldn't we be all right?" Roman asked.
Murdoch pointed overhead. 10 feet above their heads, the bulkhead ended, replaced by a series of support beams that rose several more feet to the overhead deck.
"The holds are not watertight compartments," he said. "When this hold floods, it will spill over into the number three hold and keep moving forward."
"How much flooding can she withstand?"
"Since she's empty, she should stay afloat with two holds flooded. If the seas are calm, she might hang on with a third flooded. But once the water starts hitting that number one hold, it will be all over."
Dreading the answer, Roman asked how much time they had left.
"I can only guess," Murdoch said, his voice turning low. "I'd say 2 hours tops."
Roman aimed the dimming bulb of his penlight toward the trickle of water and slowly traced it down toward the bottom of the hold. A growing pool of black water was reflected in the distance, its shimmering surface a calling card of death.
Chapter 68.
At the first visible signs of a listing stern, Zack ordered the Otok to pull away from the barge. The sinking black hulk was quickly swallowed up by a bank of fog, its death throes proceeding without an audience. Zack himself quickly turned his back on the barge and its condemned occupants.
"Make for the Numa ship," he ordered, "and kill the running lights."
The captain nodded, bringing the helm in line with the research ship's fixed position, then gradually building speed until the icebreaker was running at 10 knots. The lights of the Narwhal were unseen under the blanket of fog, so its pursuit was accomplished by radar. The research ship still held to a stationary position as the icebreaker quickly closed the gap between the vessels.
"Captain, when we approach to within 3 kilometers, I want to accelerate under full power. We'll cross her bow about 1 kilometer off to make her think we are running inland. Then we will arc back as we draw near and strike her amidships."
"You want me to ram her?" the captain said incredulously. "You'll kill us all."
Zack gave him a bemused look.
"Not hardly. As you well know, this vessel has a 5-foot-thick steel prow fronting a highly reinforced double hull. She could bowl through the Hoover Dam without a scratch. Providing you avoid the Narwhal's own heavy bow, we'll slice through her like butter."
The captain peered at Zack with grudging respect.
"You've studied my vessel well," he said brusquely. I just hope that Mr. Goyette takes the dry dock repairs out of your salary and not mine. Zack let out a deep chortle. My good captain, we play our cards right, and I'll personally buy you your own fleet of icebreakers. Though the dark night and fog masked the sea, Bill Stenseth attentively tracked every movement of the icebreaker. With his radar operator absent, one of the many crewmen sent ashore in Tuktoyaktuk, Stenseth sat down and monitored the radar set himself. He had become alerted when he noted the distant radar image slowly split in two. Correctly guessing that the barge had been separated from the tow ship, he carefully began to track both images. He anxiously watched the icebreaker close within 3 miles on an intercept course when he reached for the Marine VHF radio. Unidentified vessel approaching south at 69.2955 north, 100.1403 west. This is the research vessel Narwhal. We are presently conducting an underwater marine survey. Please give clearance of 2 kilometers over. Stenseth repeated the call but received no reply. When's the Bloodhound due up? He asked the helmsman. Dahlgren's last report was that they were still on the wreck site, so they are at least 20 minutes off. Stenseth watched the radar screen closely, noticing a gradual increase in speed by the icebreaker as it approached within 2 miles. There looked to be a slight change in the ship's course, drifting off the Narwhal's bow as if to pass her on her starboard beam. Whatever their intent, Stenseth was not in a trusting mood. Ahead a third, he ordered the helmsman. Bearing 300 degrees. Stenseth well knew that the prospect of a collision in thick fog was one of a mariner's worst nightmares. With visions of the Stockholm striking the Andrea Doria in his mind, he powered his ship to the northwest in order to avoid a similar head-on collision. With a minute degree of relief, he saw that the other vessel was holding to its southeast course, widening the angle between their paths. But the appearance of a safe passing was short-lived. When the two vessels approached within a mile, the icebreaker suddenly accelerated, nearly doubling its speed in short order. Driven by a massive pair of gas turbine engines capable of towing a string of heavy barges, the icebreaker was a behemoth of torque. Freed to run unencumbered, the tow ship turned into a greyhound, capable of slicing through the water at over 30 knots. Under Zack's order, the ship found its full legs and blasted through the waves under maximum throttle. It took only a few moments for Stenseth to detect the change in the icebreaker's speed. He held his course steady until the radar told him that the other vessel was sharply veering to the west. "Ahead flank speed," he ordered, his eyes glued to the radar screen. He was aghast at the track of the icebreaker as it swept in a short arc toward his own vessel. He shook off any doubts about the intent of the other vessel. It clearly intended to ram the Narwhal. Stenseth's order to accelerate thwarted Zack's attempt to catch the ship and crew off guard. But the icebreaker still had a decided advantage in speed, if no longer surprise. The Otak had closed within 1/4 mile before the research ship could break 20 knots. Stenseth peered out the aft bridge window, but could see nothing through the black fog. "She's coming up quick," the helmsman said, watching the icebreaker's radar smudge approach the center of the radar screen. Stenseth sat down and readjusted the range to read in 100-yard increments. "We'll let her come in tight. But when she touches the 100-yard mark, I want you to bring us hard to starboard, on a due east heading. There's still plenty of sea ice along the shore of King William Island. If we can get close enough, they might lose our radar signature against it." He gazed at an open chart, noting their distance to King William Island was over 15 miles. Much too far away, he knew, but his options were few. If they could parry a bit longer, maybe the pursuers would give up the hunt. He stood and watched the radar screen until the tailing target drew near, then he nodded at the helmsman. The heavy research ship shook and groaned as the rudder was jammed full over, the vessel heeling onto its new course. It was a lethal game of blind man's bluff. On the radar screen, the icebreaker seemed to merge with their own position, but Stenseth still caught no sight of the icebreaker. The Otak continued on its westerly course for nearly a full minute before detecting the Narwhal's maneuver and turning sharply to the east in pursuit.
Stenzeth's action gave the ship precious seconds to build more speed while the crew was alerted and ordered topside. But it wasn't long before the icebreaker was closing in on their stern once again. "Hard to port this time," Stenzeth ordered, when the Otoc crossed the 100-yard mark once again. The icebreaker anticipated the move this time, but guessed wrong and veered to starboard. She quickly took up the chase again as Stenzeth attempted to angle closer to King William Island. The faster ship quickly moved in, and the Narwhal was forced to juke again, Stenzeth opting to turn hard to port once more. But this time, Zack guessed correctly. Like a hungry shark striking from the depths of a murky sea, the icebreaker suddenly burst through the fog, its lethal prow slashing into the flank of the Narwhal. The shattering blow struck just aft of the moon pool, the icebreaker's bow slicing 15 feet in from the rail. The Narwhal nearly keeled over from the impact, shuddering sideways into the waves. A massive spray of freezing water poured over the deck as the ship struggled to regain its center of gravity. The collision brought with it 1,000 cries of mechanical agony. Steel grating on steel, hydraulic lines bursting, hull plates splintering, power plants imploding. As the destruction reached its climax, there was an odd moment of silence. Then the wails of violence turned to the gurgling moans of mortality. The icebreaker slowly slid free of the gaping wound, breaking off a section of the Narwhal's stern as it backed away. The vessel's sharp bow had been bludgeoned flat, but the ship was otherwise fully intact, its double hull not even compromised. The Otoc lingered on the scene a few moments as Zack and the crew admired their destructive handiwork. Then, like a deadly wraith, the murderous ship disappeared into the night. The Narwhal, meanwhile, was on its way to a quick death. The ship's engine room flooded almost instantly, tugging the stern down in an immediate list. Two of the bulkheads fronting the moon pool were crushed, sending additional floodwaters to the lower decks. Though built to plow through ice up to 6 feet thick, the Narwhal was never designed to withstand a crushing blow to its beam. Within minutes, the ship was half underwater. On the bridge, Stenzeth picked himself up off the deck to find the bridge a darkened cave. They had lost all operating power, and the emergency generator located amidships had also been disabled in the collision. The entire ship was now as black as the foggy night. The helmsman beat Stenzeth to an emergency locker at the rear of the bridge and quickly produced a flashlight. "Captain, are you all right?" he asked, sweeping the beam across the bridge until it caught Stenzeth's towering figure. "Better than my ship," he replied, rubbing a sore arm. "Let's account for the crew. I'm afraid we're going to have to abandon ship in short order." The two men threw on their parkas and made their way down to the main deck, which was already listing heavily toward the stern. They entered the ship's galley, finding it illuminated by a pair of battery-operated lanterns. Most of the ship's skeleton crew was already assembled with their cold weather gear, a look of fear etched in their eyes. A short man with a bulldog-like face approached the two men.
"Captain, the engine room is completely flooded and a section of the stern has been torn away," said the man, the Narwhal's chief engineer. "Water has reportedly breached the forward hold. There's no stopping it."
Stenzeth nodded.
"Any injuries?"
The engineer pointed to the side of the galley, where a grimacing man was having his left arm wrapped in a makeshift sling.
"The cook broke his arm in a fall when she hit. Everyone else came through clean."
"Who are we missing?" Stenzeth asked, quickly counting heads and coming up too short.
"Dahlgren and Rogers, the ship's electrician. They're trying to get the tender launched."
Stenzeth turned and faced the room.
"I'm afraid we must abandon ship. Every man onto the deck. Now. If we can't board the tender, then we'll use one of the port side emergency rafts. Let's make it quick."
Stenzeth led the men out the galley, stopping briefly to note that the water had already crept to the base of the superstructure. Quickening his pace, he moved onto the frozen expanse of the forward deck, fighting to keep his balance against the increasing slope underfoot. Across the deck, he saw a beam of light flash between two men cranking on a manual winch. A 12-foot wooden skiff dangled in the air above them, but the rakish angle of the deck prevented the skiff's stern from clearing the side railing. The sound of obscenities embroidered in a Texas accent rattled through the cold night air from one of the men. Stenzeth rushed over and, with the help of several more crewmen, heaved the stern up and over the railing. Dahlgren reversed the lever on the winch and quickly lowered the skiff into the water. Grabbing its bowline, Stenzeth walked the boat aft 20 feet until the water on the deck reached his boots. The crew then quickly climbed aboard by simply stepping off the narwhal's side rail. Stenzeth counted off 12+ heads, then followed the injured chef as the last man aboard, stepping into the cramped wooden tender and taking a seat near the stern. A light breeze had picked up again, blowing scattered holes in the fog while casting an added chop to the seas. The tender quickly drifted a few yards away from the dying ship, staying in sight of her final moments. They were barely away when the bow of the turquoise ship rose high into the night air, struggling against the forces of gravity. Then, releasing a deep moan, the narwhal plunged into the black water with a hiss of bubbles, disappearing to the depths below. A burning anger welled within Stenzeth. Then he gazed upon his crew and felt relief. It was a minor miracle that no one had died in the collision, and everyone had made it safely off the ship. The captain shuddered to think of the death toll had Pitt not put most of the crew and scientists ashore in Tuktoyaktuk. "I forgot the dang rocks." Stenzeth turned to the man next to him, realizing in the dark that it was Dahlgren sitting at the tiller. "From the thermal vent," he continued. "Rudy left them on the bridge." "Consider yourself lucky that you escaped with your skin," Stenzeth replied. "Good work in getting the tender away." "I didn't really want to bob around the Arctic in a rubber boat," he replied. Lowering his voice, he added, "Those guys play for keeps, don't they?" "Fatally serious about the ruthenium, I'm afraid." He held his head to the air, trying to detect the presence of the icebreaker. A faint rumbling in the distance told him the ship wasn't lingering in the area. "Sir, there's a small settlement called Joehaven on the extreme southeast tip of King William Island," the helmsman piped in from a row up. "A little over 100 miles from here. Nearest civilization on the charts, I'm afraid." "We should have enough fuel to make King William Island." "Then it will have to be on foot from there," Stenzeth replied. Turning back to Dahlgren, he asked, "Did you get a message off to Pitt?" "I told them we were vacating the wreck site, but we lost power before I could warn them we wouldn't be coming back." He tried to make out the dial on his watch. "They should be surfacing shortly." "We can only guess as to where. Finding them in this fog would be a near impossibility, I'm afraid. We'll try a pass through the area, then I'm afraid we'll have to break for the coastline and seek help. We can't risk being offshore if the winds should stiffen." Dahlgren nodded with a grim look on his face. Pitt and Jordina were no worse off than they were, he thought. Coaxing the tender's motor to life, he turned the boat south and disappeared into a dark bank of fog. Chapter 69. Pitt and Jordina had been hovering over the ship's bell when they received a brief transmission from Dahlgren that the narwhal was moving off site. Preoccupied with uncovering the bell's inscription, they had not followed up the call. The discovery that the shipwreck was the Terror proved to be a small relief for Pitt. With no indication that there was any ruthenium aboard, there was still room for hope. The Inuit must have obtained the ore from the Erebus, and perhaps she alone held the secret to the coveted mineral. The question lingered as to where had the Erebus ended up. The two ships were known to have been abandoned together, so presumably they would have sunk close to one another. Pitt felt confident that expanding the AUV's search area would turn up the second ship. "Bloodhound and Narwhal, we're beginning our ascent," Jordina radioed. "What's your status?" "We're on the move at the moment. I'm trying to get an update from the bridge. We'll let you know when I do. Over." It was the last they were to hear from Dahlgren. But having extended their bottom time, they were more concerned about reaching the surface with auxiliary power to spare. Pitt shut off the external lights and sensing equipment to save power, while Jordino did the same with the non-essential interior computers. As the submersible fell dark and they began gliding upward, Jordino sat back in his chair, crossed his arms, and closed his eyes. "Wake me when it's time to let in some fresh 10 below air," he muttered. "I'll make sure that Jack has your slippers and newspaper waiting." Pitt again reviewed the electrical power readings with a wary eye. There was plenty of reserve power for the life support systems and the ballast control pumps, but little else. He reluctantly shut down the submersible's propulsion system, knowing they would be subject to the strong currents during their ascent. Plugging the narwhal's moon pool would be out, as they would likely end up a mile or two down current when they broke the surface. And that's only if the narwhal was back on sight. Pitt shut down a few more electrical controls, then stared out at the black abyss beyond the viewport. Suddenly, an urgent cry rang out on the radio. "Bloodhound! We've been—" The transmission was cut mid-sentence and was followed by complete silence. Giordino popped forward in his chair and was returning the call even before he had his eyes open. Despite the repeated attempts, his transmissions to the narwhal went unanswered.
"We might have lost their signal in a thermocline," Giordino offered.
"Or they lost their communications antenna while running at speed," Pitt countered. They were manufactured excuses to reason away the truth neither man wanted to accept, that the narwhal was in real trouble. Giordino continued making radio calls every few minutes, but there was no response, and there was nothing either man could do about it. Pitt looked at the submersible's depth gauge and wondered if they were tied to the bottom. Since receiving the interrupted call, their ascent rate had slowed to a crawl, or so it seemed to Pitt. He tried to keep his eyes away from the gauge, knowing the more he watched it, the slower it moved. Sitting back, he closed his eyes for a time, imagining the troubles the narwhal might be facing, while Giordino diligently kept up his radio vigil. He finally opened his eyes to see they were just over 100 feet deep. A few minutes later, they rocked to the surface amid a rush of bubbles and foam. Pitt kicked on the external lights, which simply reflected back a surrounding billow of fog. The radio remained silent as they rocked back and forth in the heaving waters. Alone in a cold and empty sea, Pitt and Giordino both knew that the worst had happened. The narwhal was no more. Chapter 70.
"What do you mean the rescue team disappeared?"
The president's angry voice echoed off the walls of the White House Situation Room on the lower level of the West Wing. An army colonel, brought in by the Pentagon generals to serve as a sacrificial lamb, responded in a quiet monotone.
"Sir, the team failed to appear at the extraction site at the appointed time. The airfield support squad was not advised of any problems from the strike team and were themselves evacuated on schedule.
I was promised a low-risk mission with a 90% probability of success," the president said, glaring at the Secretary of Defense.
The room fell silent, no one wishing to antagonize the man further. Seated 2 seats down from the president, Vice President Sandecker found a touch of amusement to the inquisition. When called to an emergency meeting by the National Security Advisor, he was surprised to find no less than 5 generals seated around the Secretary of Defense in the conference room. It was not an omen of good things to come, he knew. Sandecker was no fan of the secretary, a man he found to be narrow-minded and trigger-happy, yet he quickly put his personal feelings aside for the crisis at hand.
"Colonel, why don't you tell us exactly what you know?" Sandecker said, deflecting the president's anger. The colonel described the planned mission in detail and the intelligence that supported the rescue strike. "The befuddling aspect is that there are indications the team was successful in freeing the captives. Radio intercepts from Canadian forces in Tuktoyaktuk report an assault on the holding complex and the subsequent escape of the Polar Dawn's crew. We've detected no indications that they were recaptured."
"What if the Special Forces team was simply delayed?" Sandecker asked. "The nights are short up there right now. Perhaps they were forced into hiding somewhere for a period before making it back to the airfield."
The colonel shook his head.
"We sent an aircraft back to the extraction site under darkness just hours ago. They touched down briefly, but no one was there, and additional radio calls went unanswered."
"They couldn't have just vanished," the president grumbled.
"We've analyzed satellite reconnaissance, radio traffic, and local contacts on the ground. They've all come up empty," stated Julie Moss, the president's national security advisor.
The only conclusion that can be made is that they were quietly recaptured and relocated to a new location. They might be back on the Polar Dawn, or possibly flown out of the area.
What has been the official Canadian response to our request for release of the ship and crew? Sandecker asked.
There has been no response, Moss said. We've been curtly ignored through diplomatic channels, while the Prime Minister and Parliament continue to make outlandish claims of American imperialism that are straight out of a banana republic.
They have not limited themselves to words, the Secretary of Defense interjected. They have placed their military forces on alert status in addition to their recent port closures.
That's true, Moss echoed. The Canadian Coast Guard has started turning away all American-flagged ships approaching Vancouver and Quebec, as well as Toronto-bound barge traffic. It's expected that their border crossings will be temporarily closed in a day or two.
This is getting quite out of hand, the President said.
It's even worse. We've received word that our impending natural gas imports from Melville Sound have been suspended. We have reason to believe the gas has been diverted to the Chinese, although we don't know if this was directed by the government or the gas field operator.
The President slunk into his chair with a dazed look on his face.
That threatens our entire future, he said quietly.
Sir, the Secretary of Defense declared, with all due regard, the Canadian government has wrongfully blamed us for the loss of their Arctic ice lab and damage to one of their patrol craft. They have illegally captured a U.S. Coast Guard vessel in international waters and are treating the crew as prisoners of war. They have done the same to our Delta Forces team, or perhaps killed them and the ship's crew as well, for all we know. On top of that, they are threatening our entire nation with energy blackmail. Diplomacy has failed, sir. It is time for another option.
We've hardly met the threshold for a military escalation, Sandecker said bitterly.
You may be right, Jim.
But those men's lives are at stake, the President said. I want a formal demand presented to the Prime Minister for the release of the crew and rescue team within 24 hours. Do it privately, so that the media-happy PM can save face. We can negotiate for the ship later, but I want those men freed now. And I want a reversal on those natural gas shipments.
What's our response if they don't comply? Moss asked.
The Secretary of Defense piped up. Mr. President, we've drawn up several options for a limited first strike engagement.
A limited engagement? What is that supposed to mean? The President asked.
The conference room door opened, and a White House aide silently entered and handed a note to Sandecker. A limited engagement, the Secretary of Defense continued, would be deployment of the minimum resources required to incapacitate a high percentage of Canada's air and naval forces through surgical strikes. The President's face turned red.
I'm not talking about a full-blown war. Just something to get their attention.
The Secretary of Defense quickly backed down.
We have options for single-target missions as well, he said quietly.
What do you think, Jim? The President asked, turning to Sandecker.
A grim look spread across the Vice President's face as he finished reading the note and held it up before him.
I've just been informed by Rudy Gunn at Numa that their research vessel Narwhal has gone missing in the Northwest Passage off Victoria Island. The ship is presumed captured or sunk with all hands, including the director of NUMA, Dirk Pitt. The Secretary of Defense broke into a wolfish grin as he gazed across the table at Sandecker.
It would seem, he said pointedly, that we have suddenly found your threshold.
Chapter 71 The United States had launched armed incursions into Canada on at least a half-dozen occasions. The bloodiest invasion occurred during the Revolutionary War, when General Richard Montgomery marched north from Fort Ticonderoga and captured Montreal, then moved on Quebec City. He was joined by a secondary force that had entered Canada via Maine, led by Benedict Arnold. Attacking Quebec City on December 31, 1775, the Americans briefly captured the city before being beaten back in a fierce battle with the British.
short of supplies and reinforcements, as well as the loss of Montgomery during the fight, the Americans had little choice but to break off the foray into Canada. When hostilities heated up again during the War of 1812, the Americans launched repeated strikes into Canada to fight the British. Most ended in failure. The most notable success occurred in 1813, when Toronto, then York, was sacked and its parliamentary buildings burned to the ground. The victory would prove to haunt the U.S. a year later when the British marched on Washington. Angered by the earlier destructive act, the British returned the favor by taking a torch to the public buildings of the American capital. With colonial independence achieved in 1783, Canada and the United States quickly grew to be amicable neighbors and allies. Yet the seeds of distrust have never completely vanished. In the 1920s, the U.S. War Department developed strategic plans to invade Canada as part of a hypothetical war with the United Kingdom. War Plan Red, as it was named, called for land invasions targeting Winnipeg and Quebec, along with a naval assault on Halifax. Not to be outdone, the Canadians developed Defense Scheme No. 1 for a counter-invasion of the United States. Albany, Minneapolis, Seattle, and Great Falls, Montana were targeted for surprise attacks in hopes that the Canadians could buy time until British reinforcements arrived. Time and technology had changed the world considerably since the 1920s. Great Britain no longer stood in Canada's defense, and America's military might made for a dominating power imbalance. Though the disappearance of the Narwhal angered the president, it hardly justified an invasion. At least, not yet. It would take weeks to organize a ground offensive anyway, should things degrade that far, and he wanted a quick and forceful response in 48 hours. The strike plan agreed to, barring the release of the captives, was simple yet pain-inducing. U.S. Navy warships would be sent in to blockade Vancouver in the west and the St. Lawrence River in the east, effectively blocking Canada's foreign trade. Stealth bombers would strike first, targeting Canadian fighter air bases at Cold Lake, Alberta, and Bagotville, Quebec. Special Forces teams would also be on standby to secure Canada's major hydroelectric plants in case of an attempted disruption in exported electric power. A later strike would be used to seize the Melville gas field. There was little the Canadians could do in response, the Secretary of Defense and his generals had argued. Under threat of continued airstrikes, they would have to release the captives and agree to open terms on the Northwest Passage. All were in agreement, though, that it would never come to that. The Canadians would be warned of the circumstances if they didn't comply with the 24-hour deadline. They would have no choice but to acquiesce. But there was one problem that the Pentagon hawks had failed to consider. The Canadian government had no idea what had become of the Polar Dawn's crew. Chapter 72. Trapped in their sinking iron coffin, the Polar Dawn's crew would have begged for another 24 hours, but their prospect for survival was down to minutes. Murdoch's prediction had so far held true. The barge's number 4 hold had steadily filled with water until spilling over into the number 3 compartment. As the stern sank lower under the weight, the water poured in at a faster rate. In the small forward storage compartment, the deck listed ominously beneath the men's feet as the sound of rushing water drew nearer. A man appeared at the aft hatch, one of Roman's commandos, breathing heavily from scaling the hold's ladder.
"Captain," he gasped, waving a penlight around the bay until spotting his commander.
"The water is now spilling into the number 2 hold."
"Thank you, Corporal," Roman replied. "Why don't you sit down and take a rest? There's no need for further recon." Roman sought out Murdoch and pulled him aside.
"When the barge starts to go under," he whispered, "will the hatch covers pop off the holds?"
Murdoch shook his head, then gave a hesitant look.
"She'll surely go under before the number 1 hold is flooded. That means there will be an air pocket underneath, which will build in pressure as the barge sinks. There's probably a good chance it will blow the hatch cover, but we might be 500 feet deep before that happens."
"It's still a chance," Roman said quietly.
"Then what?" Murdoch replied. "A man won't last 10 minutes in these waters.
He shook his head with irritation, then said,
Fine. Go ahead and give the men some hope.
I'll let you know when I think this tub is about to go down, and you can assemble the men on the ladder. At least they'll have something to hang on to for the ride to perdition. At the entry hatch, Bjorkes had listened to the exchange, then resumed his hammering on the locked latch. By now he knew it was a futile gesture. The tiny hammer was proving near worthless against the hardened steel. Hours of pounding had gouged only a small notch in the lock spindle. He was many hours, if not days, away from wearing into the lock mechanism. Between whacks, he looked over at his fellow captives. Cold, hungry, and downcast, they stood assembled, many staring at him with hopeful desperation. Surprisingly, there was little trace of panic in the air. Their emotions frozen like the cold steel of the barge, the captive men calmly accepted their pending fate. Chapter 73. The Narwhal's tender was perilously overloaded. Designed to hold 12 men, the boat easily accommodated the 14 crewmen who had evacuated the ship. But the extra weight was just enough to alter her sailing characteristics in a rough sea. With choppy waves slapping at her sides, it was only a short time before a layer of icy water began sloshing around the footwells. Stenseth had taken hold of the tiller after a laborious effort to start the frozen motor. With a pair of 10-gallon cans of gasoline, they had just enough fuel to reach King William Island. But Stenseth already had an uneasy feeling, realizing that they would have to march in the footsteps of Franklin's doomed crew if they were to reach safety at Joe Haven. Leery of swamping the boat, the captain motored slowly through the white-capped seas. Fog still hung heavy over the water, but he could detect a faint lightening to the billows as the brief Arctic night showed signs of passing. He refrained from turning directly east toward King William Island, holding to his word to make a brief search for Pitt and Giordino. With next to no visibility, he knew the odds of locating the submersible were long. To make matters worse, there was no GPS unit in the tender. Relying on a compass distorted by their nearness to the magnetic North Pole, Stenseth dead-reckoned their way back to the site of the shipwreck. The helmsman estimated that they had collided with the icebreaker some 6 miles northwest of the wreck site. Guessing at the current and their own speed, Stenseth piloted the boat southeast for 20 minutes, then cut the motor. Dahlgren and the others shouted out Pitt's name through the fog, but the only sound they heard in reply was the slap of the waves against the tender's hull. Stenseth restarted the motor and cruised to the southeast for 10 minutes, then cut the motor again. Repeated shouts through the fog went unanswered. Stenseth motored on, repeating the process once more. When the last round of shouts fell empty, he addressed the crew. We can't afford to run out of fuel. Our best bet is to run east to King William Island and try and locate some help. Once the weather clears, the submersible can be found easily. And I can tell you that Pitt and Giordino are probably a lot more comfortable in that sub than we are. The crew nodded in agreement. Respect ran high for Pitt and Giordino, but their own situation was far from harmless. Getting underway once more, they ran due east until the outboard motor sputtered to a halt, having sucked dry the first can of gas. Stenseth switched fuel lines to the second can and was about to restart the motor when the helmsman suddenly cried out, Wait! Stenseth turned to the man seated nearby.
I think I heard something, he said to the captain, this time in a whisper.
The entire boat fell deathly quiet, each man afraid to breathe as all ears were trained to the night air. Several seconds passed before they heard it as one. A faint tinging sound in the distance, almost like the chime of a bell.
That's Pitt and Giordino, Dahlgren shouted. Has to be. They're tapping out an SOS on the Bloodhound's hull.
Stenseth looked at him with skepticism. Dahlgren had to be wrong. They had moved too far from the submersible's last known position. But what else could be signaling through the bleak Arctic night? Stenseth engaged the outboard motor and sailed the tender in an ever-widening series of circles, cutting the throttle at periodic intervals to try to detect which direction the sound was coming from. He finally noted a rising pitch emanating from the east and turned in that direction. The captain motored slowly but anxiously, fearful that the tapping might cease before he had determined a true bearing. The fog blew in thick wisps while the morning dawn still struggled to appear. As close as they might be, he knew it would be all too easy to lose the submersible if it fell silent. Fortunately, the clanging went on. The rapping only grew louder, audible even over the rumble of the outboard. Changing course with slight shifts to the tiller, Stenzith zeroed in on the sound until it echoed in his ears. Cruising blindly through a dark bank of fog, he suddenly cut the throttle as a huge black shape rose up in front of them. The barge seemed to have lost its mammoth scale since Stenzith had last seen it, being towed by the icebreaker. Then he saw why. The barge was sinking by the stern, with nearly half of its length already submerged. The bow rose at a rakish angle, reminiscent of the last minutes of the Narwhal. Having just witnessed his own ship's demise, he knew the barge was down to its last minutes, if not seconds. Stenzith and the crew reacted with disappointment at their discovery. Their hopes had been pinned on finding Pitt and Giordino, but their disillusionment quickly turned to horror when they realized that the barge was about to go under, and that the tapping sound came from someone locked aboard. Chapter 74. Dahlgren played a flashlight beam across the exposed deck of the barge, searching for an entry point, but found only fixed bulkheads ahead of the forward hold. "Take us around to the starboard side, Captain," he requested. Stenzith motored the tender around the towering bow of the barge, slowing as he approached the forward hold. The rhythmic metallic rapping suddenly became noticeably louder. "There!" Dahlgren exclaimed, finding the side compartment hatch with his light. A chain was visible, wrapped around the hatch door lever and secured to a rail stanchion. Without a word, Stenzith ran the tender alongside the barge until it bumped into a metal railing that angled out of the water. Dahlgren was already on his feet and leaped onto the barge's deck, landing aside the partially flooded number 3 hold hatch cover. "Be quick, Jack," Stenzith yelled. "She's not long above water." He immediately backed the tender away from the barge, not wanting to get caught in its suction should it suddenly plunge to the bottom. Dahlgren had already sprinted across the angled deck and up a short flight of steps to the locked storage compartment. Banging a gloved hand on the hatch, he shouted, "Anybody home?" The startled voice of Sergeant Bjorquez replied instantly.
"Yes. Can you let us out?"
"Will do," Dahlgren replied. He quickly studied the securing length of chain, which had been crudely knotted around both the hatch lever and the deck stanchion. There had been little slack to begin with, but the twisting girders of the sinking ship had pulled the chain drum tight. Checking each end under the beam of his flashlight, he quickly realized that the stanchion knot was more accessible, and he focused his efforts there. Yanking his gloves off, he grabbed hold of the knot's outer links and pulled with all his might. The frozen steel links dug into his flesh but refused to budge. Gathering his breath, he tugged again, putting the full power of his legs into the effort while nearly ripping his fingers from their sockets. But the chain wouldn't move. The deck beneath his feet took a sudden lurch, and he felt the ship twist slightly from the uneven pull of the rapidly flooding holds. Releasing his mangled and frozen fingers from the links, he looked at the chain and tried another tack. Leaning over the landing in order to attack from a right angle, he began kicking at the knot with his boots. Inside the storage compartment, he could hear panicked shouts from several voices urging him to hurry. From the water nearby, a few of the Narwhal's crew yelled over, echoing the sentiment. As if to add its own pressure, the barge let out a deep metallic groan from somewhere far beneath the surface. With his heart pounding, Dahlgren kicked at the chain with his toe. Then he stomped with his heel. He kicked harder and harder with a growing sense of anger. Furiously he kicked, as if his own life depended on it. He kept on kicking until a single link of chain finally slipped over the tightly wound coil. It created just enough slack to allow the next link to slip through with a subsequent kick, and then one more. Dahlgren dropped to his knees, jerking the free end of the chain through the loosened knot with his numb fingers. He quickly uncoiled the chain from the stanchion, allowing the hatch lever to move free. Rising to his feet, he yanked up on the lever, then pulled the hatch open. Dahlgren didn't know what to expect and fumbled with his flashlight as a number of shapes moved toward the hatch. Turning the light inside, he was shocked to find 46 gaunt, frozen men staring back at him like a savior. Bjorkes was closest to the hatch, still clutching his small hammer.
"I don't know who you are, but I'm sure glad to see you,"
the sergeant said with a toothy smile.
"Jack Dahlgren, of the Numa research ship Narwhal. Why don't you boys come on out of there?"
The captives rushed through the hatchway, staggering out onto the listing deck. Dahlgren was surprised to see several of the men dressed in military garb, small U.S. flags on their shoulders. Roman and Murdoch were the last to exit and approached Dahlgren with a relieved look on their faces.
"I'm Murdoch of the Polar Dawn. This is Captain Roman, who tried to rescue us in Kugluktuk. Is your vessel standing by?"
Dahlgren's astonishment at the realization he had found the captured Americans was tempered by the news he had to bear. "Our ship was rammed and sunk by your tow vessel," he said quietly.
"Then how did you get here?" Roman asked.
Dahlgren pointed to the tender just visible a few yards off the sinking barge.
"We barely escaped ourselves. Heard your rapping on the hatch and thought it was a submersible of ours."
He looked around at the beaten men standing around him, quietly trying to fathom their ordeal. Their escape from death was temporary, and now he felt like their executioner. Turning to Roman and Murdoch, he spoke with grim apology.
"I'm sorry to have to tell you, but we don't have room to take on a single man."
Chapter 75 Stenzeth watched the waves lap over the barge's number two hold, leaving just the number one hold and bow section still above water. Why the barge hadn't yet headed for the bottom he couldn't say, but he knew her time was short. He turned his gaze to the haggard men lining the rail with looks of pleading desperation in their eyes. Like Dahlgren, he was shocked to count so many men step out of the storage hold. The blatant attempt at mass murder by the crew of the icebreaker astounded him. What sort of animal was commanding the tow ship? His fears turned toward the safety of his own men. When the barge went under, he knew it would turn into an ugly free-for-all as the castaway men tried to climb aboard the tender. He couldn't risk swamping the already overloaded boat and sending his own men to their grave. He kept the tender at a safe distance from the barge, wondering how he could get Dahlgren off without the rest of the men trying to climb aboard with him. He spotted Dahlgren talking to two men, one of whom pointed toward the flooded stern of the barge. Dahlgren then stepped to the rail and shouted for Stenzeth to approach. The captain eased the tender up the barge just beneath Dahlgren, keeping a wary eye on the other men. But none of them rushed the boat as Dahlgren climbed aboard.
"Captain, please head to the stern of the barge, about 200 feet back. Quickly," Dahlgren urged.
Stenzeth turned the tender around and cruised past its sinking hulk toward the hidden stern. He didn't notice Dahlgren pull off his boots and strip down to his underwear before pulling his parka back on.
"They had two Zodiacs stowed aft," he shouted by way of explanation.
Little good they would do now, Stenzeth thought. They've either drifted off or are tied to the deck 40 feet underwater.
He noticed Dahlgren standing in the bow pointing his flashlight toward something bobbing in the water.
"Over there," he urged.
Stenzeth guided the tender toward a number of dark objects floating on the surface. They were two pair of conical-shaped protrusions that bobbed in unison several feet apart. Drawing closer, Stenzeth recognized them as the tapered pontoon ends of a pair of Zodiac boats. The two inflatable boats were standing on end under the water, their bows affixed by a common line to the barge below.
"Anybody have a knife?" Dahlgren asked.
"Jack, you can't go in the water," Stenzeth exhorted, realizing that Dahlgren had stripped off his clothes.
"You'll die of exposure."
"I ain't planning a long bath," he grinned in reply.
The chief engineer had a folding knife and pulled it out of his pocket and handed it to Dahlgren.
"A little closer, please, Captain,"
Dahlgren asked, slipping out of his parka. Stenzeth inched the tender to within a few feet of the Zodiacs, then cut the throttle. Dahlgren stood in the bow, flipped open the knife, then without hesitation took a deep breath and dove over the side. An expert diver, Dahlgren had dived in cold seas all over the world, but nothing had prepared him for the shock of immersion into 28-degree water. 1,000 nerve endings instantly convulsed in pain. His muscles tensed and an involuntary gasp of air burst from his lungs. His entire body froze rigid from the shock, ignoring the commands from his brain to move. A panic sensation then took hold, urging him to immediately head for the surface. Dahlgren had to fight the instinct while forcing his dead limbs to move. Slowly he overcame the shock, mentally forcing his body to swim. He had no flashlight, but he didn't need one in the black water. Brushing a hand against one of the Zodiac's hulls gave him all the guidance he needed. Kicking forcefully, he descended several feet along the hull before feeling it angle inward toward the prow. Using his fingers to see, he reached beyond the bow until grazing the threads of the taut bowline. Grasping it with his free hand, he pulled and kicked his way down the line, searching for the mooring point to both Zodiacs. The exposure to the frigid water quickly began to slow down his motor skills, and he had to will himself to keep descending. 20 feet below the Zodiac, he reached the barge, his hand sliding against a large cleat that was securing the lines to both boats. He immediately attacked the first line with the knife, sawing furiously to break it. The blade was not sharp, however, and it took him several seconds before he cut the line free and it jerked toward the surface. Reaching for the second line, his lungs began to ache from holding his breath while the rest of his body turned numb. His body signaled him to let go of the line and kick to the surface, but his inner determination refused to listen. Shoving the knife forward until it met the line, he sawed the blade back and forth with all his remaining energy. The line broke with a twang that was audible underwater. Mimicking the other inflatable, the second Zodiac shot to the surface like a rocket, arching completely out of the water before splashing down onto its hull. Dahlgren missed most of the ride, being jerked only a foot or two toward the surface before losing his grip on the line. The momentum propelled his ascent, though, and he broke the surface, gasping for air as he flailed to stay afloat with his frozen limbs. The tender was on him instantly as three sets of arms reached over and plucked him from the water. He was briskly rubbed dry with an old blanket, then dressed in multiple layers of shirts and long underwear contributed by his fellow crew members. Lastly wedged into his parka and boots, he stared wide-eyed at Stenzith while shivering incessantly. "That's one cold pond," he muttered. "Don't care to try that again." Stenzith wasted no time, whipping the tender alongside the Zodiacs until their bow lines could be grabbed, then he gunned the motor. With the Zodiacs bounding in tow, the tender shot across the open expanse of water toward the rapidly diminishing bow structure. The water level had crept partway across the number one hold hatch cover, yet the big vessel still refused to let go. The captives were huddled forward of the hold, certain that the tender had left them to die. When the outboard motor suddenly grew louder, they peered into the darkness with anxious hope. Seconds later, the tender appeared out of the gloom with the two empty Zodiacs in tow. A few of the men began to cheer, and then more joined in, until the barge erupted in an emotionally charged howl of gratitude. Stenzith drove the tender right up the face of the number one hold, skidding to a halt as the two Zodiacs rushed alongside. As the haggard men quickly climbed in, Murdoch stepped over to the tender. "God bless you," he said, addressing the entire crew. "You can thank that frozen Texan up front as soon as he stops shivering," Stenzith said. "In the meantime, I suggest we both get away from this behemoth before she sucks us all under." Murdoch nodded and stepped over to one of the Zodiacs. The inflatable boats were filled in no time and quickly pushed away from the barge. With flooded motors and no paddles, they were at the mercy of the tender for propulsion. One of the Narwhal's crew tossed a tow line to one of the Zodiacs, while the other inflatable tied on in tandem. The three boats drifted off the sinking barge before Stenzith took up the slack and engaged the outboard motor. There was no lingering or emotional farewell to the dying barge, which had represented only misery to its men held captive. The three small boats plowed east, quickly leaving the stricken vessel behind in the fog. With nary a gurgle, the black Leviathan, its holds nearly filled to the top, silently slipped under the waves a moment later. Chapter 76. "It's as black up here as the bottom is at 1,000 feet. There was little exaggeration in Giordino's assessment of the scene out of the submersible's viewport. Just moments before, the Bloodhound had punched through the surface amid a boil of foam and bubbles. The two occupants still had hopes of finding the lights of the Narwhal twinkling nearby, but instead found a cold, dark sea enshrouded in a heavy mist.
Better try the radio again before we're completely out of juice, Pitt said. The submersible's battery reserves were nearly extinguished, and Pitt wanted to conserve the remaining power for the radio. He reached down and pulled a lever that sealed the ballast tanks closed, then shut down the interior air filtration system, which was barely functioning on low voltage. They would have to crack the top hatch for fresh but bitterly cold air. They called on the surface, but their radio calls continued to go unanswered. Their faint signals were picked up only by the Otok and blithely ignored at the order of Zack. The Narwhal, they were now convinced, had vanished from the scene.
Still not a word, Giordino said dejectedly.
Contemplating the radio silence, he asked,
How friendly would your pal on the icebreaker be if he had a run-in with the Narwhal?
Not very, Pitt replied. He has a penchant for blowing things up with little regard for the consequences. He's after the ruthenium at all costs. If he's aboard the icebreaker, then he'll be after us as well.
My money says that Stenzeth and Dahlgren will give him a handful.
It was little consolation to Pitt. He was the one who had brought the ship here, and it was he who had placed the crew in danger. Not knowing what had happened to the ship, he assumed the worst and blamed himself. Giordino sensed the guilt in Pitt's eyes and tried to change his focus.
Are we dead on propulsion? He asked, already knowing the answer.
Yes, Pitt replied. We're at the mercy of the wind and current now. Giordino gazed out the viewport.
Wonder where the next stop will be.
With any luck, we'll get pushed to one of the Royal Geographical Society islands. But if the current throws us around them, then we could be adrift for a while.
If I had known we were going to take a cruise, I would have brought a good book. And my long underwear.
Both men wore only light sweaters, not anticipating the need for anything warmer. With the submersible's electronic equipment shut down, the interior quickly turned chilly.
I'd settle for a roast beef sandwich and tequila myself, Pitt said. Don't even start with the food, Giordino lamented.
He leaned back in his chair and crossed his arms, trying to maintain warmth.
You know, he said, there are days when that cushy leather chair back in the headquarters office doesn't sound so bad.
Pitt looked at him with a raised brow.
Had your fill of days in the field?
Giordino grunted, then shook his head.
No. I know the reality is, the second I set foot in that office, I want back on the water. What about you?
Pitt had contemplated the question before. He'd paid a heavy price, both physically and mentally, for his adventurous scrapes over the years. But he knew he'd never have it any other way.
Life's a quest. But I've always made the quest my life.
He turned to Giordino and grinned.
I guess they'll have to pry us both off the controls. It's in our blood, I'm afraid.
Helpless to control their fate, Pitt sat back in his chair and closed his eyes. Thoughts of the Narwhal and her crew scrolled through his mind, followed by visions of Lauren back in Washington. But mostly his mind kept returning to a lone portrait of a broad-shouldered man with a menacing face. It was the image of Clay Zack.
Chapter 77
The submersible pitched and rolled through the choppy seas while driven south at nearly 3 knots. The Arctic dawn gradually emerged, lightening the thick gray fog hanging low over the water. With little to do but monitor the radio, the two men tried to rest, but the plunging interior temperature soon rendered it too uncomfortable for sleep. Pitt was adjusting the overhead hatch when a scraping sound filled the interior and the submersible jarred to a halt.
"Land ho," Giordino mumbled, popping open his sleepy eyes.
"Almost," Pitt replied, peering out the viewport. A light breeze blew a small opening in the fog, revealing a white plateau of ice in front of them. The unbroken expanse disappeared into a billow of mist 100 feet away.
A good bet there is land on the opposite side of this ice field, Pitt speculated. And that's where we'll find a hot coffee stand?
Giordino asked, rubbing his hands together to keep warm.
Yes,
roughly 2,000 miles south of here. He looked at Giordino. We have 2 options. Stay here in the cozy confines of our titanium turret, or take a crack at finding relief. The Inuit still hunt in the region, so there could be a settlement nearby. If the weather clears, there's always a sporting chance of flagging down a passing ship. He looked down at his clothes. Unfortunately, we're not exactly dressed for a cross-country excursion. Giordino stretched his arms and yawned.
Personally, I'm tired of sitting in this tin can. Let's go stretch our legs and see what's in the neighborhood.
Agreed. Pitt nodded. Giordino made one last attempt to contact the narwhal, then shut down the radio equipment. The two men climbed out of the top hatch and were promptly greeted by an 8-degree chill. The bow had wedged tightly into the thick sea ice, and they were easily able to step off the submersible and onto the frozen surface. A stiffening breeze began to scatter the low-hanging mist. Nothing but ice lay in front of them, so they started trudging across.